My Life as an Animal, Serialization, Week 7. This episode is brought to you by animalaid.org.uk, who campaign peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promote cruelty-free living.
It's now time to continue our audiobook here on UK Health Radio, My Life as an Animal, written by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith.
My Life as an Animal.
While I was not New Scotland Yard's man of the moment, I suspect Sarah felt even more unloved by the headmistress of the primary school at which she did part-time work at the after-school play centre. One of the teachers was breeding gerbils, presumably to amuse the children with something funny and wriggly. In one of the classrooms, Sarah found about a dozen of them in a glass case that was resting on a window ledge with the glaring sun streaming through directly into their space. To someone who might say, "Why are you fussing about gerbils?" I would answer, "Gerbils might be very small against man, the giant, and sold cheap in pet shops. But that says nothing about these animals' real worth, how each one's life is precious to that individual, and that, like us, they tremble with the approach of danger." Sarah found the deputy head and explained her concern, while he stared motionless at the glass container. He said finally that they were happy gerbils. There was nothing to be concerned about. Sarah looked at him gravely and said he would do something, or she would take it further. The gerbils remained on the ledge, and so she wrote to the head of science at the London Education Authority, expressing her anger and distress. After some days without a response, she phoned and pressed him to take action. And he did. She came into play school soon after that call, and the gerbils were gone from the window ledge. But almost simultaneously with making that discovery, Sarah was told she was wanted in the head teacher's office. She found the head and a deputy standing solemnly alongside each other, waiting for her to walk through the door. Without preliminaries, they launched into a joint verbal assault, complaining that Sarah had been disloyal, had betrayed them, and telling her how deeply disappointed they were. Sarah is not one to wilt in such situations, and it seems that the rest of the staff cocked an ear as the temperature and the volume kept on rising until the scene culminated in Sarah being fired. When she took on that job, there was something routine skipping and football going on. But the dominant force was the TV screen, around which would be a gathering of yawning, somnambulant children. Sarah outcompeted it with her enthusiasm, encouraging the take-up of signs of life activities such as painting, playing with toys, and interacting with each other. Somebody at Play Centre HQ, or wherever the big Play Centre decisions are made, must have known her worth because despite being fired, she was instantly offered another equivalent post and began again. In Sarah, people see an exuberant, voluble and passionately intense individual overflowing with confidence. And it's true, she wakes up furious with the world, makes a couple of speeches at me and wants to put everything right by breakfast, by which time she might be phoning up radio stations and writing letters to newspapers. "You're lucky," people have said to her. "You're naturally brave." But she isn't. She has had to fight her nerves, speaking up, protesting against what is wrong, making herself unpopular in certain quarters. That doesn't come naturally. But it does get easier. The first call to a radio station, the first time speaking in public, there were her ice-covered mountains with the constant terror of a slip. But now, to continue the slippery metaphor, she equips herself with the right boots and rugged clothing, which translates into, "Research your subject. Know what you're talking about." At the end of 1987, I was contacted with a job offer by renowned Fleet Street figure Dennis Hackett, editor of Queen and Nova magazines in his sparkling, innovative Prime and later a fixer and special projects maestro at several national dailies, including The Mirror and Express. Hackett had recently been appointed editorial boss at The Observer's Sunday magazine and wanted me to join his writing team. I was flattered. He had been reading and enjoying pieces I had written for Time Out. The classic Fleet Street newspapers, The Observer among them, had a gritty black and white enchantment about them when I was a young teen. Most people bought at least one title every morning, and the definition of the news was whatever the papers decided it was. Those were the days when typewriters made a clackety-clack noise as the keys were struck, and newspaper men supped booze at lunchtime until they were near senseless, but still filed their copy to deadline. Newsrooms were big, lively places, crackling with edgy exchanges and barked orders as deadlines approached. And at the heart of it was human drama. Not Hollywood invented, but real. Real victory, defeat, love, betrayal and murder. The reporter's job was to find those stories and tell them, without fuss, to a prurient, gossip-hungry public. Hackett said he wanted the kind of thing I'd been doing for Time Out. They read nicely, he said. They were good and pacey. I asked him if I would be given time to put together the sort of pieces that had taken his fancy. Getting social outcasts to trust you and open up. People like rough sleeper Big Bill McCabe, or the Irish travellers who park for several days on the green in the middle of a South London roundabout. That all takes time. How long do you need? He asked, aiming a faintly sceptical look in my direction. They can take a month, I answered, although some are quicker and I work on more than one at a time. We went on to agree that I would be contracted to deliver 15 full-length features every 12 months for a set amount. The annual total was not impressive, but the payment per feature was better than I'd ever previously received. It was late November 1987. We recognised that by the time I had worked out my notice period at Time Out, it would be close to Christmas. We shook on the deal and resolved to meet up again in the new year. And so I said my sad farewells to the team at Time Out and tried to think of myself from then on as an observer man. My new daily commute took me south of the river to their new see-through glass and steel HQ, just a short distance from Battersea Power Station. A new start with new colleagues, a new editor, and three or four sound ideas for stories. By the time I'd formally started, I had already made progress on what Dennis and I agreed would be my first feature. All about fur. Fur was a particularly volatile subject at that time due to the recent dissemination of images of fur-bearing animals being crushed and broken in metal traps, being anally electrocuted, cage by cage, on fur farms, and much else that was gruesome and vicious about that unglamorous industry. My article would detail the leading role London plays in financing the global industry. I would pay a visit to an English fur farm and to a Hudson Bay fur auction in London, and I would examine how the involvement of a small number of Native Americans, generally in the poorly rewarded trapping end of the business, was being used to try to silence critics. Attack fur, went the implicit message, and you attack these good, noble people. Settled at my new desk, I began by contacting a friend living in Toronto. He knew people who could lay their hands on good source material, such as back copies of Trapper and Predator Caller magazine, which tells you more than you ever wanted to know about North America's fur harvesters. I also fixed an appointment with animal-friendly Tory minister Alan Clark, who was about to unveil a proposed new labelling scheme for certain fur products. The wording would be includes fur from animals commonly caught in leg-hold traps. Through my Toronto friend, I got hold of a copy of a letter written by a fur-bearer biologist employed by the New Brunswick provincial government. Addressed to one of his colleagues, it contained the following admission. The native argument has greatly increased our lobbying efforts in Europe to maintain the fur trade. The reason you hear the native side so much is that it's the most effective argument to keep us all trapping. In the same correspondence, the author admitted that in his own province, natives trap just 5% of the annual catch. I could find no one fiercer in his denunciation of the ethnic guilt tactic than a Native American called Paul Hollingsworth, founder of the Native Animal Brotherhood. The fur trade, he said, is the most insidious source of prejudice against native peoples. The Fur Institute of Canada and the government drag token Indians all over Europe to get support for the white trapping, and the white fashion and fur industries, as if natives were some sort of noble gods. In contrast, back at home, they cut education programs that could get natives out of subsistence jobs like fur trapping. Statistics from the early 90s showed that Canada's native people were 6 times more likely to go to jail than a white person, and 3 times more prone to kill themselves. Their education and living conditions were also substantially inferior. Thus, the gap between how the industry promoted itself, lean models with lustrous hair staring languidly at their own image in long mirrors, and the greedy, atavistic reality was vast. I was simultaneously making good progress with a second prospective feature. This one centred on 5 friends from the Liverpool area, at least 3 of whom were ex-Everton football hooligans. With their terriers, lurchers and ferrets to hand, they would set about whatever wildlife was within reach. Their own law of nature was simple. If killing wild animals or getting them to fight each other for sport is bad, it wouldn't feel so good. In that sense, they operated to the same ethical standard as the traditionalist tally-ho hunting set, only without the ceremony. They did, however, dress the part in wax jackets and flat caps. I asked them how they saw themselves. The deluded answers included, as a sporting conservationist, a friend of nature, and a gentleman collector. The sort of collector who would be prepared to clear a nest of all its eggs, this one told me, even if it meant consigning the species concerned to extinction. Someone else would do it, he reasoned, if not me. I'd been at the Observer for just 4 or 5 weeks when Dennis Hackett suddenly left his post for reasons I never did discover. There was gossip that he couldn't settle because he was unable to muster the requisite enthusiasm for the job. Whatever the cause, my own position was now exposed. I was Hackett's man with an unusual contract. I was trusted to deliver considered pieces that took time to produce. A conventional editor would want more output for the same money. Within a few days, Hackett's successor made an appearance. We exchanged pleasantries, and she asked what I was working on. I told her about the fur piece and what I was now calling City Hunters. She smiled and thanked me, but was non-committal. It was on her 3rd or 4th day that she arrived in the office in a fur coat that came down, and I'm going to have to use the words literally, literally to her shins. I know there are people who come over all dribbly dreamy when they behold a shiny, lustrous fur coat. They dream of things glamorous and beautiful. Hollywood, the Ritz, tall cold drinks cutting through a dazzling blue ocean on a billionaire's yacht. But I didn't see that. I saw Fred and Ethel Flintstone in their caveman animal skins. Anachronistic and awkward. I hate to think how many coyotes or foxes had had their skin stripped from their backs for the glorification of this tall, lean, glossy Scot. Even without thinking of the animals, it was an ugly thing. It's okay, she called over. It's farmed. I write about farmed fur in the piece I'll soon be giving you, I confirmed. It's not for us, she said the next morning. It's Sunday morning. Picture it. Our reader opens her Observer magazine and she wants uplift, not all this suffering. It's a serious piece, yes, but that's part of the mix, isn't it? Serious journalism. It just hasn't come off. I'm sorry, it's not what I'm looking for. She then asked me to help out with a piece on airports with difficult and unusual approaches, making it tough for the pilot to land. Could I do Hong Kong? I wrote up Hong Kong. Did I find it fascinating? No, I didn't. But there will be readers who did, and for them I'm happy. I finished City Hunters, read and proofed it several times, until I was convinced it was a clean, swift read with no clumsy syntax to trip up on or jarring words to slow the reader down. I handed it to Angela, our new editor, as she was leaving for the evening and awaited a verdict. 4 days passed without comment. I saw her en route to the canteen and asked if she'd had a chance. She finished my sentence. To read it yet? I've had a look, yes, it's perfectly fine, but not one for us. I'm sorry. That was the end of it. We parted company. Incompatibility. My contract specified that I was due 6,000 or 7,000 pounds, and I got an assurance from her that it would be paid, and it was. But here I was, being put out with the bins, having arrived just weeks before, full of unquenchable optimism and positivity. Well, they were still unquenched, and they would remain so. The two pieces Angela turned down were certainly up to scratch. In fact, City Hunters is among the best features I ever wrote, for its phrasing, rhythm, and content. I took it to the Independent, which was just 2 years old at the time, and much admired across Fleet Street. Its bold use of pictures made it the photographer's favourite, and freelance writers liked it because it was doing new things, such as refusing to genuflect before the royals and covering politics without the tiresome automated bashing of the other side. The following Saturday, September the 10th, 1988, the Indy launched a new second section called Weekend. City Hunters occupied the whole of the front page. The Observer wreckage reminded me that I was better off as a freelance, following my own enthusiasms and goals rather than occupying a slot in a newsroom from which a particular kind of output is expected. How do you expand your reach when your movement is so limited? As a freelance, you work harder, and earning a living is practically impossible. And it works only to the extent that it did for me by having receptive commissioning editors in four, five or more major titles. Alexander Chancellor, editor of the Saturday Independent magazine, was not a natural match for me and my writing, but I liked and respected him as an editor. His background was Eton and Trinity College, Cambridge, and he had a grandfather who was the first governor of Southern Rhodesia. Alexander made his name by resuscitating the ailing right-wing Spectator magazine, of which he was editor from 1975 to 1984. He doubled its circulation. Notwithstanding all of that, he was always receptive to my ideas, even the ones that didn't make the final cut. Some of those that did were seriously at odds with received opinion, but he went with them because the kind of magazine he wanted to edit was diverse and at times troublesome. Fitting into the troublesome category was my recounting of a startling new origin of AIDS theory that was beginning to cause high-level fretting in US scientific circles. The theories that scientists have championed usually focus on dark continents, sex, and initiation rites, or people going deep into the bush and getting bitten by a monkey. The new theory, which puts scientists themselves in the frame, centred on a 1950s mass polio vaccination campaign across Central Africa, orchestrated by a US-based scientist. One or more of his vaccine batches was contaminated, goes the theory, with simian immunodeficiency virus, SIV, the monkey equivalent of HIV. Contamination would have been a logical outcome of a vaccine production system that used ground-up monkey kidneys as a culture medium for growing the weakened polio virus. And if any of those monkeys killed for their kidneys had been infected with SIV, it wouldn't have been picked up because SIV wasn't known at that time. The former director of the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia, Dr. Hilary Kaprowski, was the man who designed and executed the Africa vaccine program. The Independent article includes a 1956 photograph of him, white-coated, holding a little monkey by the scruff of the neck alongside a tray of glass vials. Kaprowski's work on polio vaccines began in America in the late 40s. In 1952, he conducted preliminary trials on mentally defective children living in a New York State institution. He then tried to do a big trial in Northern Ireland, but had to give up on this when the attenuated, weakened polio virus, from which he was culturing the vaccine, appeared to return to virulence. In autumn 1958, the Congo trials began, initially in what is today the Republic of Burundi. Rural Africans travelled to assembly points where they had the oral vaccine squirted from syringes into their mouths. Some 12,000 people daily were fed the vaccine Nearly half of them were children. Altogether, 245,000 children, mostly inhabitants of Rwanda and Burundi, were inoculated during 1958, and a further 75,000 children, all under the age of five, were vaccinated by the end of 1959. In the city now known as Kinshasa, in the modern-day Democratic Republic of Congo. That's the bare bones of it. This troubling episode, which has direct relevance for our own age because of biomedical science's continued use of animal tissue, came to light during the persistence of a couple of medical researchers well outside the scientific mainstream. Eva Sneed, a writer and doctor from San Antonio, Texas, first suggested a link between AIDS and polio vaccine contaminated by monkey virus in a 1987 series of articles for alternative medical journals, but they were little heeded. Building on Sneed's work was Australian-based medical researcher Louis Pascal. He was the first to identify the 1958 Congo vaccine program as the event which could have marked the beginning of AIDS in Africa. After having previous papers cold-shouldered by scientific journals, he began circulating his 10-page hypotheses, Samizdat style, asking each recipient to make a photocopy and pass it on. That's how I received my own copy. When the Congo theory was finally published above ground, it appeared not in a scientific journal, but in Rolling Stone magazine. Some of the biggest names in biological science now felt ready to come forward and demand further investigation of old vaccine batches and the recovery of any other historic clues. The battle over the Congo vaccine would get increasingly intense in the years ahead, and the focus would switch to chimpanzee virus. All manner of tests were conducted on viral and vaccine samples, and inevitably, more monkeys were tortured through a fresh round of infection experiments. Kaprowski, meanwhile, fought back through the courts and forced an apology from Rolling Stone. Did contaminated polio vaccine cause AIDS? I asked in my April 1988 independent piece. None of the laboratory or other investigations supported that claim, and so the verdict had to be not proven. But what was clear, even in 1988, was the evidence of risk and damage caused by the biomedical use of animal tissues, body parts, and excretions. It was time to call a halt. In a similar vein, Alexandra agreed to my going to Palo Alto, California, to visit a biotech company that was breeding immune-deficient mice and then surgically inserting into them bits of the internal organs from aborted human fetuses. These visionaries of the grotesque claim that their selectively bred and surgically altered mice constituted a biological first, a properly functioning human immune system inside another species. That made the mice ideal, I was told, for trying out new drugs meant for humans. They called the mouse Skidoo. The skid part referred to severe combined immune deficiency, while Hugh signalled that aborted human material had been surgically inserted. There were different versions of Skidoo. The favourite of the company's science director, which he referred to as his full house fetal implant, called for parts of the thymus gland to be tucked in beside one of the mouse's kidneys, lymph node to be lined up beside the other kidney, and human liver cells, which were injected close to the tail. As you might have expected, the mice's living space provided zero comfort. They were confined in shoebox-sized Perspex containers, row upon row on stacked shelves in rooms of heavily filtered air. They fed on irradiated food pellets and defecated on sterilized shredded newsprint. The biotech company's marketing man was convinced they'd hit the jackpot with Skidoo and spoke of doubling their staff to 160 by the end of the year, 1991, and becoming a major global pharmaceutical company within 10 years. But it didn't happen. Because for all their ghoulish manipulations, the pitiable little Skidoo mouse did not function as they imagined she would. It turned out that she had some mouse immune function after all, thereby making interpretation of test results a palpably unreliable business. By 1997, the company had been swallowed up by a major Swiss-based pharmaceutical giant. Humanized mice are still in use, their grievous suffering continuing largely unrecognized, and it is still the case that the information obtained by making them sick and then dosing them with experimental drugs is a poor guide to how a human being would react to the same substances. When the wheel stopped spinning, the Skidoo mouse of Palo Alto was just another brutal conceit on the part of the biomedical research vanguard. The features I wrote for the indie magazine and for the other titles often had a world-improving objective, but no matter how zealous I might have been feeling, the number one quality any piece must have is readability. And that comes from a strong storyline, at the heart of which are one or more compelling individuals. Escape from the East End met that test. It was an old-fashioned tale of a landed Kent aristocrat, Lord Northbourne, who each year played host to troubled, impoverished kids from the Stepney area of East London. The Londoners went down in groups of 15 to 25 throughout the summer, under the care of Bob LaValiant and his Stepney Children's Fund charity. For a week they camped out, swam, did target practice, cans, not pheasants, and wallowed in mud baths. Christopher Northbourne took an equable view of his guests' bad manners and tantrums. I saw them steal his keys and wreck the steering lock of his minibus. They told him to fuck off and worse. But they also clutched him passionately, fought each other for his attention, and wept in his arms when it was time to leave. Around £15,000 in donations, as well as offers of help, came the charity's way from people moved by what they had read. Other pieces I did for Alexander's Saturday magazine included a look at animal rights activism. From the arson and sledgehammer tendency, huge in the media imagination, tiny in reality, to the staging of veggie and vegan food tasting events across the country, ever more common, but scarcely reported nationally. Jim Junkies described the obsessional world of competition bodybuilding, with its ceaseless weight training and routine use of anabolic steroids, a chemical that transforms some adepts into Jekyll and Hyde monsters. My story about a feisty little capuchin monkey, Billy Boy, tracked him from his early life, spent as a Howlett Zoo exhibit, onto a pet shop in Hounslow, West London, where he was bought by a casino receptionist. The casino man thought he could win the male dominance battle with an 18-inch tall Billy Boy by getting into a fistfight with him. Billy Boy survived the fall, and when I found him, he was caged at the bottom of a garden in Nasing, Essex, under the new ownership of a postman come conservationist called Lee Warner. Warner believed his special calling was to encourage more keeping and breeding of pet monkeys as a hedge against species extinction. This made no sense for at least three reasons. One, people with pet monkeys can't meet their most basic needs, and so the monkeys suffer. Two, there are already more capuchins than anyone wanted thanks to profligate breeding by zoos. Three, repatriating former pets and zoo exhibits to their natural habitat is too complex and expensive, which is why it rarely happens. I can barely remember a regular back-and-forth conversation with Alexander, but that's probably because we were both fairly subdued in each other's company. His senior editorial colleague, Justin Picardi, was the nuts and bolts facilitator for my pieces and would always be in Alexander's office with us as I pitched my ideas. Although he didn't do a lot of talking, if there was a gap or an inconsistency in a proposal, he'd ask the question that would reveal it. When a proposal was rejected, it stung a little. Two or three rejections in a row gnawed at your confidence, and you wondered if your antennae were still in working order. Alexander died in January 2017. His literary editor at The Spectator, Geoffrey Wheatcroft, said of him, He was a completely wonderful editor, even if we couldn't always understand why he was. We loved him. I was simply grateful that Alexander Chancellor was there to say yes to numerous and varied feature articles, some of which editors of most other mainstream titles wouldn't have touched.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
Where's the parade? By 1988, Sarah and I had lived together for 10 years. The birds and the bees and the law on inheritance told us it was time to get married. We decided, portentously, that it should happen on the 8th day of the 8th month of 1988, and it would be a discreet micro-event, hopefully minus the emotional push and pull that comes with large gatherings of not always compatible families and friends. Even Davy was absent, but only because being there would have meant him missing a camping holiday with his schoolmates that he'd long been excited about. But he would be at the reception, a meal for 12 or 15 intimates, the following week at a fine Thai restaurant in Soho. As we readied ourselves for the big day, we witnessed some true magic. It came during our hunt for the rings. We didn't want South African gold. We took seriously the trade and cultural boycott of the apartheid regime, since it was almost impossible to identify gold items that weren't South Africa linked. We decided on silver. Something simple and elegant, but everything we found looked tinny and cheap, especially the ones with the glittering quasi-precious stones. We checked in every kind of jewellery and trinket store, the upmarket independents and the cheap local branches of national chains, but found nothing. Time was running out. We were already into August. Though it looked unpromising, we decided to call in on a little improvised second-hand bric-a-brac shop that was no more than half a mile down the road from our flat. We told the manager what we were after, two silver bands to signify we were betrothed. No gaudy embellishments. "Well, I've got these," he said, "but they're just something a student made." And they were. The larger, broader one, a perfect fit for my chunky finger. And the other, tailor-made for Sarah. And I believe they cost just £6 or £7 for the pair. That they were the work of a student, rather than anonymous output of the global trade in precious metals, made it uncannily perfect. The wedding was at Camden Registry Office. It was a minimalist affair, with just three friends present to bear witness and take photographs. The unexpected bonus was a registrar welcoming the presence of our two dogs, elderly Oski and Penny, the anarchist. He said that dogs were typically less troublesome than most people. Sarah wore a white blouse, a dark pencil-lined skirt and black wide-brimmed straw hat that was brightened with a red rose. As a sign of our continuing straitened circumstances, my dark jeans and patterned tie were borrowed from downstairs neighbours, Rob and Alex, although the white shirt was my own. The wedding party now moved on to Hampstead Heath, where Sarah and I did moody posing for photos in the long grass and while clinging to the trunks of a sycamore and a weeping willow. Rob banged off a quick roll of black and white images on an old-fashioned metal camera, and the end result was very classy. It had been a perfect wedding day, free of the usual fuss and worry. It was tranquil, peaceful, and woozy, with wine and sweet liqueurs. There were regular gusts of laughter as we remembered the daft things we did in our youth. And it was cheap, or shall I say, low budget. We could afford no idling time in those days. The next feature article already beckoned, and Sarah had to prepare for an imminent demo she was jointly organising against London Zoo's treatment of unglamorous forgotten animals, such as the little mongooses from the African savannah, who were kept in a 10-foot by 8-foot glass case, decorated with a few dead branches and some rocks. With our growing volume of background research materials, we badly needed one of those reassuringly heavy metal filing cabinets that screech and groan however carefully you pull out a drawer. In fact, we needed three of them to house all the reports, news cuttings, letters and trade journals that were currently stacked in cardboard boxes. There was room for just one cabinet in the flat. The other two we parked on the landings at the top of the stairs of the three-story converted house whose top flat we occupied. It was after the battle of the school gerbils that Sarah had begun looking for allies. She found them in the form of a small group of campaigners who, in late 1985, were engaged in an 11th-hour offensive, hence the group's name, against a new piece of proposed legislation that would govern the conduct of vivisection in the UK for decades. It was called the Animals Scientific Procedures Bill. Its aim, the government insisted, was to reduce suffering and cut the number of animals used. But I came to understand that its true purpose was the fast-tracking of applications to conduct animal research. The unnecessary red tape, aka accountability, with which commercial and academic interests are famously impatient, would be disappeared, and licensed researchers, if equipped with the right paperwork, could continue exploring their lunatic hypotheses by submitting animals to experiments involving poisoning, burning, starving, electrical stimulation, infection with lethal pathogens, and surgical mutilation. Prior to the Act's passage, 11th-hour supporters gathered every Sunday morning at the Brown Dog statue in Battersea Park, the little dog being a famous victim of early 20th century medical vivisectors. They marched from his statue to Parliament Square, where there would be banners, posters, leaflets, speeches, and, with luck, broadcast and print media reps waiting to interview the organisers. There weren't many 11th-hour followers, but those on board were strong, stoical, suffragette types. I was marching with them one Sunday when I encountered a writer friend from my music days. He gave me a thumbs up and said, "That's terrific. Where's the main part of the march? Around the corner?" There was nothing around the corner, I told him. This was it. A cheery homily would have come in handy, but my imagination was in the doldrums. "From a few strong warriors," my friend shouted, "come many big triumphs." "You took the words out of my mouth," I responded. "Some animal work can't be planned. It jumps at you and demands action." One such case began with a letter from a woman who'd seen that Sarah was a regular contributor to the letters page of the local paper. On her council housing estate, the woman wrote, there was a dog, Reno, who for 3 months had been living alone in a burnt-out flat, barking day and night. Reno belonged to a dysfunctional, intimidating family that no one had wanted to tackle. It was said to have been their young son who started the fire, after which they moved on but didn't want Reno with them. A son came back daily for a few minutes to feed him, otherwise he was alone in the charred ruins. Sarah walked by herself to the burnt-out house. I was in the Isle of Wight checking out pig farms, which was located just yards from a moderately busy road. She immediately heard the distressed barking, but couldn't see Reno for all the hardboard panelling that was hammered across windows and the front doors. She quickly got to work, contacting the local authority, the police, a dog charity, animal-friendly journalist Brian Shaw, and the ward councillor, and pleaded for a resolution of the dismal situation. No one would help. The RSPCA's view was that the dog was being fed, and therefore there was nothing they could do. Davy, by now a young man of 22 and with his own flat in South London, happened to be visiting his mum while the abandoned dog drama was being played out. After a long dog walk with Sarah, they went to Reno's apartment. It was about 3 p.m. They heard the barking. Davy saw how distressed his mother was, exclaimed, "Oh, fuck it," and punched a hole in the hardboard covering the front door. This allowed him to reach in, take the catch off the lock, open the door, run down the stairs, clip a lead on Reno's collar and call out for Sarah to go quickly while he raced with Reno away from the estate, across a busy road and onto Hampstead Heath. He ran for 3 or 4 more minutes before, after satisfying himself no one was following, slowing down to a walking pace. It was a particularly brave act by Davy, I thought, and certainly Sarah felt the same. He had no idea what he was running into when he tore down the stairs and encountered Reno for the first time. Newspaper littered the floor. The place stank of pissy dog poo. Reno was a large Dalmatian male. He might have attacked, given the sudden, almost violent intrusion by a stranger into his solitary, messed-up world. But he allowed the lead to be clipped on and ran smoothly alongside Davy all the way to the heath. A call was made to a friend. Reno was picked up and homed with a good person. After a couple of days, Sarah wrote a letter for publication to the local newspaper. She told Reno's story and how the agencies, both state and voluntary, that should have been there to help, all declined to get involved. The dog was now gone, Sarah wrote. She hoped that he had landed on his feet. The following week, a letter from the RSPCA was published. They were happy to report that positive action had been taken and the dog was in good health and high spirits. The deceit was breathtaking, especially because they had no idea whether something wonderful or terrible had befallen a dog they refused to help when he was in his greatest need.
The station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
On reflection, I remember being impressed by Davy's quiet resolve when, age 15, he helped me with a time-out investigation. Its purpose was to test new voluntary guidelines that were intended to prevent sales of faddy martial arts weapons to under-18s. The targeted weaponry included claws, knives, scythes, swords, blowpipes, throwing stars, chains, and daggers. It was a simple setup. We would visit a number of stores, go to the till with one or more of these sharp-edged weapons, and see who asked for proof that he was 18 and that he also held a martial arts commission license. Davy did not remotely look as old as 18. He was a soft-skinned 15-year-old whose voice still operated in the higher register. We called on 6 shops, and in every one of them he could purchase whatever martial arts weapons took his fancy. Not one of them asked to see proof that he was MAC licensed, and just one asked his age but didn't seek proof. I had no contact with him once he'd entered the shop, so the excuse that they knew he was under my care could not be used. The 6th shop in Streatham High Road was run by an ex-copper. The fact that I can run through that article all these years later is due to Sarah. She preserved every one of my decades-old Fleet Street stories, laying them flat in big red plastic boxes. I had not looked at the great majority of them for years, but writing this book pushed me into episodes of nostalgic rumination. I'm too old and decrepit with Parkinson's for forced modesty. I'll just say that I'm impressed by the quality of the writing of many of those pieces and by the new ground I was often breaking. For example, the life of a factory farm pig told from the vantage point of a week spent working in the sheds and, relatedly, an unblinking close-up of pigs being slaughtered. That one was called Slaughterhouse Tales and resonated more than any piece I wrote. There are also explicit challenges to the powerful biomedical science lobby, whose commanding figures are probably more used to being flattered by science journalists than being held to account. My most pointed challenge came through a 2-page feature in The Guardian in March 1991 about the Human Genome Project, HGP. This was the global multi-billion dollar initiative aimed at sequencing all 3 billion chemical units that make up the genome of a human being. It was a massively oversold enterprise, with President Bill Clinton describing it as more important than the invention of the wheel. The dangerously simplistic reasoning at its heart was that 40 genes inherited from our parents were the cause of most disease. If we could identify the aberrant DNA sequences, we would be on our way to purging humanity of age-old maladies, from cancer to alcoholism. My Guardian piece was deeply sceptical. It argued that it is unrealistic to assume that because scientists have the tools to detect more of the tiny increments of life, they see things any clearer. The precise function of 90% plus of our DNA was unknown then and remains unknown today. Rather than admit a knowledge gap, they call it junk DNA. Just 2% of our DNA escaped the junk tag. This was the proportion that forms itself into genes, which code for the manufacture of our physical bodies. But even that 2% was poorly understood. A biologist writing at the time in New Scientist magazine argued that genes are important, undoubtedly, but they are players in a complex picture that involve different cellular components fulfilling different functions, depending on time, place, and microenvironment. As to the project's underlying purpose, I wrote in 1991 that its goals lie in a marketplace that exists to exchange products for profit rather than produce improved health for the masses. I also pointed out that the Human Genome Project had been rolling for 3 years. Yet despite it being billed as the most significant global endeavour in the history of biological science, I had yet to see in the mainstream media anything like a searching critical analysis, least of all from science correspondents themselves. The response from the summit of the biomed establishment was personal and furious. Leading the charge was Sir Walter Bodmer, head of the HGP's Global Coordination Body, and also the Director General of the Imperial Cancer Research Fund. Equally irritated with me for daring to challenge the official version was Professor Paul Nurse, President of the Genetical Society, Oxford. With other biomedical notables, they were given maybe 1,500 words in the next issue to shred my article. The following week, a letter from the editor of Issues in Reproductive and Genetic Engineering was published. Jalna Hanmer described as outrageous Bodmer and Nurse's foaming denunciation of my informative piece, They had flung at it words such as reactionary, misinformed, biased, lacking in understanding, nonsense, inaccurate, mischievous, and malicious. I suggest, wrote Hanmer, the use of this terminology evinces a determination to eliminate any challenging analysis of the decision to map the human genome. As Andrew Tyler reports, this project is being criticized both in private and in public by genetic and other scientists. All these years later, I would say that my analysis had been proven correct. The genetics revolution has delivered a great many costly diagnostic and testing tools. DNA databases have been created, and it has given birth to a huge market in genetically altered mice for use as disease models. But nothing in the way of remedies or palliatives that are remotely commensurate with the huge sums spent and the promises made. There were further clashes with Bodmer in the pages of the New Statesman, arising from my criticism of medical research charities, such as his own, ICRF, that conduct or fund animal research. I described the use of animals as cruel and medically unproductive because data from animal tests cannot be reliably applied to people. Another of the articles I pulled from the Red Box was an Evening Standard piece on the hostility engendered by a Corporation of London proposal to remove hundreds of trees from Hampstead Heath. Expert opinion had determined that the heath was over-treed and that it needed to be taken back to something like its original flat, heathland condition. Eventually, widespread outrage developed at the thought of losing yet more trees, additional to those brought down during 3 years of freak hurricane and drought weather. And even before the start of any new official programme of tree felling, men with chainsaws were hacking down what were claimed to be diseased specimens, but which often looked healthy to those of us who examined sections of the trunks. There could be no complaint about lack of information. A thick, expensive-looking brochure set out, in deadening detail and using the correct horticultural terminology, why what was to be done had to be done. We were to think of it like the fixing of a leaky roof. Messy, but imperative. The measures, said the brochure, were restorative. The landscape, in parts, in desperate need of revitalization. Initially, people were convinced by the gloss and promises. But when the words on the page were read without preconceptions, there it was. The tree felling was even clearly signalled in before and after graphics of different locations in which 30 to 50 trees at a time would vanish. We never managed to come up with an accurate total, but many hundreds would not have overstated it. Limes, oak and beech, as well as the detested pest species, sycamore, were all threatened.
That was My Life as an Animal by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith. Produced by Tom Davidson and adapted for UK Health Radio by Monkey Nut Audiobooks. My Life as an Animal is available on Audible and audiobook sites. Be sure to tune in next time to hear more from this title. This audiobook is published by Monkey Nut Audiobooks in Hampshire, UK.